Please rise. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. If I may proceed with a brief introduction.
Yes.
Martin Lessner from Young Conaway, Stargate & Taylor, on behalf of plaintiff below. I'd also like to introduce at counsel table Roger Huggins of the Pennsylvania Bar, the firm of Gottfried Greenwood, and Michael McDermott, associate at Young Conaway, Stargate & Taylor.
Welcome, sir. Welcome back, Mr. McDermott.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce my partner, Michelle Conaway.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, David Jenkins for appellants. We represent three appellants here. They are Samuel Katz, an individual, Community Sports Partners, LLC, and Intersport Capital Advisors, Inc. The first two, Mr. Katz and Community Sports Partners, were defendants in the Chancery Court of Chancery below. Intersport Capital Advisors was an additional counterclaim plaintiff. Let me give a brief overview of the facts. There will be other facts that I will attempt to interweave in my argument. This lawsuit is the result of a business deal that went sour. The plaintiffs invested in Community Sports Partners, LLC. The idea behind CSP, as everyone calls it, was to develop and manage community sports facilities. Intersport was another member of CSP. Mr. Katz was the controlling stockholder and the president of Intersport. The idea was that CSP, Community Sports Partners, would identify, develop, and manage various community-based recreational facilities. The idea was that it would start off with ice skating facilities and with luck would expand to others. The plan was for CSP to use the proceeds of non-recourse public revenue tax-exempt bonds to finance these facilities. Under Internal Revenue Service regulations, an entity, a private entity such as CSP, could not own those facilities. It had to be a public-related entity, and therefore CSP could only manage the entities thereafter. The plaintiffs invested in CSP on April 28, 2000. They invested $2.1 million and signed CSP's operating agreement, which I'll discuss more in a moment. One principal, as I have explained to CSP, was Mr. Katz. One of his subordinates was Mark Robbins, who unfortunately became intertwined in the dispute. By the fall of the year 2000, the high-yield tax-exempt revenue bond market had fallen apart. So the initial idea of issuing bonds into this market was finished. They couldn't do it. The initial facility that CSP was going to develop was called Mount Laurel. It's Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Without the original proposed bond money, there was no way for the public entity to finance the purchase of the land. So it was proposed and eventually accepted that CSP would buy the land, which it did in December 2000. In July 2001, it transferred the land to Community Sports Partners in Roman II, despite the identity or the similarity of the names. They were controlled by very different people. Community Sports Partners 1 was controlled by more or less Mr. Katz. Community Sports Partners number 2 was controlled over 90% by the plaintiffs here. Community Sports Partners Roman II agreed to pay Community Sports Partners almost $1 million for the land and the facilities that it had developed. Some amounts were paid, but most were not. Indeed, over $600,000 was not paid until this litigation. Skipping ahead just a moment, the Mount Laurel facility was eventually built by Community Sports Partners II, and who owns it today and is operated today. Walking back in time a bit until we get up to this lawsuit. Plaintiffs caused Community Sports Partners II to fail. They did so in two ways. First, they failed to pay the hundreds of thousands of dollars that they owed to Community Sports Partners. And in January of 2002, they killed the Brick Township, New Jersey deal, which was CSP's best chance at that time, by refusing to agree to certain terms proposed by Brick Township. In late February 2002, the next month, plaintiffs learned that Mark Robbins, Mr. Katz's subordinate, had embezzled money from these entities. Mr. Katz, who did not know about this embezzlement until that time, fired him immediately. 8 months later, in October 2002, plaintiffs filed this lawsuit in the Court of Chancery, During discovering this action, it was revealed that Mr. Robbins had a checkered past. He'd been in prison on a number of occasions and had filed for bankruptcy. We have two arguments today. The first is that plaintiff's claims are barred by the operation of the integration clause in the Community Sports Partners Agreement. The Court of Chancery denied the defendant's motion for summary judgment below. The second argument is that the Court of Chancery improperly granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on its claim for rescission. Let me take them in that order. Excuse me. Fighting a bit of a cold today. Plaintiffs had two legal theories on which they sought to recover below. The first was common law fraud in the inducement, and the second was pursuant to the Pennsylvania Securities Act. I'll do them in that order. We believe that an essential element of both claims is just is that the plaintiffs justifiably relied on the allegedly fraudulent misrepresentations made by the defendants. With respect to common law fraud and inducement, we don't think there's any dispute that reliance is an element of that. There is a dispute over whether reliance is an element of the Pennsylvania Securities Act, and I will touch on that in a moment. In the Community Sports Partners Agreement, the one signed by plaintiffs and the operating document here today, plaintiffs contractually agreed that there were no prior or contemporaneous agreements, understandings, inducements, or conditions that were not part of the Community Sports Partners Agreement. Now, plaintiffs claimed that there were two types of misrepresentations. That's what they sued on below and were successful in. The first was Mr. Robbins' checkered background, which they were not told, and it is indisputable they were not told about it prior to their investment. Mr. Cass didn't know about it. And the second set of facts in which they're suing are the facts concerning the so-called independent feasibility studies. Now, it is also indisputable that no facts concerning either the feasibility studies or Mr. Robbins' background are set forth in the Community Sports Partners Agreement. The Court of Chancery, however, held that the integration clause, when this argument was raised below, was not sufficiently specific to bar plaintiff's fraud in the inducement claims. That's one of the holdings from which we appeal. Let me look at the common law fraud in the inducement first before we get to the Pennsylvania Securities Act. The Court of Chancery did not decide whether Pennsylvania or Delaware law applied. It said that they were the same, and we have proceeded on that assumption. The Court of Chancery analyzed matters pursuant to Delaware law. We did so in the briefs, and we will do the same here.
In the opinion, didn't the Vice Chancellor really make an alternative holding, try to make an independent, an alternative holding, at least with regard to the securities claim?
We do not read him as having done so, Your Honor. We read him as having made a clearly made a determination pursuant to fraud in the inducement. He had to in order to reach the result he achieved. He certainly discussed whether there were the Pennsylvania Securities Act. We did not read him as ultimately determining what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court might have done under that act. It was discussing matters which the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has never reached, and he was attempting to determine what they might have reached if they were to hold. We view him as discussing it certainly, but ultimately deciding, but it doesn't make any difference because plaintiffs win on the common law fraud and the inducement, so I don't have to reach that. I should just alert Your Honors, I just realized the time has just started ticking for me.
We realize it. I was going to surprise you by telling you you don't have as much time as you thought you had later.
I just noted that, Your Honor. Thank you. Going back to common law fraud and the inducement, now many courts have held that an integration clause, similar to the one here, bars fraudulent inducement claims by sophisticated parties. The Court of Chancery has done so on at least three occasions. The Superior Court has done so on at least one occasion in Delaware and courts across the nation. This court, as we read it, has not spoken on that topic, and I will get to that in a minute.
Is that because in the lead case, the investors weren't sophisticated?
That's correct, Your Honor. Norton versus Poplos is a case in which this court, 22 years ago, did discuss the topic of whether or not a fraud in the inducement claim could survive an integration clause. The people there were consumers. It was a common common form real estate contract. We did not read that case as barring the use of an integration clause where there are sophisticated parties. More to the point, whether we read it that way, obviously both the Court of Chancery and the Superior Court have read it the same way. Now, I'm speaking to the court that wrote Norton versus Poplos. It's always difficult to say what this court meant, but that is our best read on the Norton versus Poplos subject, Your Honor. Turning back to the fraud and the inducement claim, the question is, therefore, assuming that Norton versus Poplos does not bar the claim, the defense on, under the integration clause, this is a claim of contract interpretation. What does the phrase agreements, understanding, inducements, or conditions mean? As we explain in brief, given those words their plain meaning, the integration clause does demonstrate the plaintiffs could not properly rely on prior representations of fact and entered into the agreement. Now, the Court of Chancery below said, well, this just means that there were no separate contracts or considerations. We respectfully disagree. If that's had all the contract had meant, they could have stopped with the word agreements. Instead, it goes on to use the words understandings, inducements, or conditions.
Well, I realize these aren't your facts, but let's suppose, hypothetically, the organization that you were investing in was completely run by criminals, and the person encouraging you to sign up for an agreement like this knew they were criminals. This is a hypothetical. And you say, we've got great people, they're going to do a good job, you really ought to invest. And then we have an integration clause. If we rule in your favor and that hypothetical becomes a real case in our court, are we saying that if you sign up to invest in an organization run by criminals, that's just tough luck? You should have done due diligence?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may answer that a little more completely. With non-sophisticated parties, such as a real estate contract, where they do not have bargaining power and it's a take-it-or-leave-it situation, this court, as well as most courts in the nation, have said, no, we're not going to use an integration clause to bar fraud and the inducement claim. You just don't have bargaining power. These are sophisticated parties. This was a heavily negotiated agreement. If, in your honor's example, if I sit there and I know that my friends and my colleagues are criminals and I represent to you and say, they have no criminal record, these are great people, there's a way around that. The sophisticated party can say, fine, we think it's important we think it is an important fact, the quality of your associates. You can put that in the agreement. Sophisticated parties do that all the time. There are many agreements that do risk the representations on which people rely. It's typically financial representations and not whether their associates have criminal records, but there's no reason not to do so. As several of the Court of Chancery decisions recognized, if the fact is that important for an investor's decision, you can put it in saying, we are relying upon this, and that gets around the integration clause. Now, going back to the actual argument here, we set forth in our brief why the phrase understandings, inducements, or conditions covers the facts here. And we spent several pages doing that, but maybe it doesn't have to be that complex. Let's just look at the word inducements. The cause of action here is fraud in the inducement. That's what it's called. The plaintiffs, however, when they signed the CSP agreement, agreed that there were no inducements other than those set forth in the contract. And the inducements that they are now saying, they say they were induced to enter into this contract based upon these feasibility studies. And they were induced to enter into the contract on the belief that Mr. Robbins had no criminal record. Those inducements are not in the Community Sports Partners Agreement, and there's no dispute about that. And so it could come down to just being that simple. Now, the Court of Chancery obviously disagreed with that, and that's why we're here. Court of Chancery suggested that an additional anti-reliance clause is necessary in order to reach the conclusion that we wish to reach. With respect to the Court of Chancery, that, we believe, results in redundancy. That is, if we are correct in that the wording in the contract as it exists is sufficient to cover these claims, there's no need to have, just under normal rules of contract interpretation, there's no reason to have additional language. That results in redundancy, which is normally frowned upon in determining contracts. Now, on this whole issue, plaintiffs essentially avoid it. They never explain in their answering brief in this court why the Court of Chancery's interpretation of the contract was correct, and they never explain why our analysis is wrong. Let me turn to, briefly, the Pennsylvania Securities Act, as I attempted to respond to Justice Holland. We do not understand the Court of Chancery to have reached a decision as to what the Pennsylvania Securities Act holds with respect to these issues. And we would completely understand if this court did not, in the first instance, decide to rule on that. I'm going to go ahead and analyze it briefly anyway, because the plaintiffs have raised it in their answering brief. Plaintiffs make two main arguments. The first is that one section of the Pennsylvania Securities Act voids any attempt to waive the Act's requirements. And the second is that reliance is not an element of a cause of action under the Pennsylvania Securities Act. Waiver we covered in our briefs, but we turn to reliance, which is the critical argument here. Now, Court of Chancery acknowledged that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has not decided the issue. Three Pennsylvania federal district courts, all three districts, have done so, and all have held that reliance is an essential element under the Pennsylvania Securities Act. And they did so because the substantive provision under which plaintiffs sue, it's Section 1401, was modeled on Section 10b-5, and there's no dispute that Section 10b-5 of the 34 Act does require reliance. The Court of Chancery, however, did not rely upon the federal district court cases in Pennsylvania, but instead looked to two state cases, one in Utah and one in Alabama, interpreting those states' versions of the Uniform Act. It also appeared to believe, when looking at the federal securities laws, that it must look only at the 33 Act as opposed to the 34 Act. And this is because the section of the Pennsylvania securities laws that gave plaintiffs the private cause of action, Section 501, was indirectly modeled on Section 12.2 of the 33 Act, and Section 12.2, at least most courts have held, doesn't require reliance. We believe, however, the court is Court of Chancery was too limited in what it did. It looked at Section 1703 of the Pennsylvania Securities Act, which says that the Pennsylvania Securities Act should be construed to coordinate the interpretation with related federal litigation. It thought it was looking solely at the 33 Act, as we've explained. It should have been looking at both acts. At this point, who knows what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court would do, and we, as I said, we completely understand that this court did not want to enter into that morass without having the Court of Chancery look at it first.
Well, help me understand the opinion. I'm looking at subsection D. The title is, Plaintiffs Have Also Proved Their Claim Under the Pennsylvania Securities Act. And then I go over a few pages where that discussion ends, and the Vice Chancellor says, in sum, plaintiffs have met their burden to show no genuine dispute of material fact precludes the entry of summary judgment in their favor on their 1-5018 claim.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it looks to me like the Vice Chancellor decided it.
I apologize. He decided on the Pennsylvania Securities Act, but not whether or not reliance was a necessary factor. I apologize. I misstated before. What we understand he did was say, I don't view this integration clause as sufficiently clear to cover the allegations, sufficiently clear to bar the allegations in the complaint, and that would have to be effective both under the Pennsylvania Securities Act and under the common law. What we do not think he did was decide whether or not, for example, reliance was a necessary element of a cause of action under the Pennsylvania Securities Act. I apologize, my prior answer was misleading.
Mr. Jenkins, under my liberal interpretation of clock mismanagement, you are now in your rebuttal time. Do you want to save it or move on?
I think, Your Honor, under the circumstances, I will save my time and for rebuttal and turn it over to appellees now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. It was impossible for me to tell one way or the other.
May it please the Court, Martin Lessner for plaintiffs below. The Court of Chancery properly held that plaintiffs were entitled to rescission under both the Pennsylvania Securities Act and the common law of fraudulent inducement, negligent misrepresentation. The Court of Chancery also properly held that a boilerplate integration clause found in practically every commercial agreement or any agreement does not act to bar claims under the Securities Act, does not act to bar negligent misrepresentation claims, and does not act to bar common law fraudulent inducement claims. The Court of Chancery was backed by an extensive record, and its opinion is well supported in its 83-page opinion. Although it is lengthy, the Court had a lengthy recital of the facts, the key facts of this case are that Mr. Katz induced the plaintiffs to invest in Community Sports Partners by presenting what was represented to be independent feasibility studies done by Jack Vivian of JRV. And these independent management and financial feasibility studies. He also induced the plaintiffs to invest by putting forth Mark Robbins as his trusted associate, a man with 20 years of business experience, and a man who, along with Mr. Katz, would be the fiduciaries in running CSP. The feasibility studies were a key element in Mr. Katz's pitch to get the plaintiffs to invest their $2.1 million and to make Mr. Katz their fiduciary. They were also the cornerstone of CSP's business plan, which was to convince townships to sell bonds which would finance community recreational facilities, which CSP would manage but not own for profit. And a key requirement of selling those bonds was independent feasibility studies. Now, what was undisclosed was that the feasibility studies, which were purportedly done by independent JRV, were completely done by Mr. Katz and Mr. Robbins. The work that was attributed in the feasibility studies was all done by Mr. Katz and his employees. The charts, the graphs that said the research and the findings were JRV were all Katz and Robbins. Mr. Vivian never considered himself independent. In fact, one of the two feasibility studies that was shown to our clients, Dr. Vivian never saw him until his deposition. It was completely made up. The Court of Chancery held that that was a material misrepresentation entitled to rescission. Also, Mr. Katz's right-hand man, his trusted associate, a person who was touted in the prospectuses and investment portfolio as being a 20-year veteran of new business initiative, his right-hand man, his fiduciary, it turns out that during those years, he was in jail for a good part of the time, having been convicted of marijuana smuggling, armed robbery, and various other felonies. This was after Mr. Katz had said, yeah, I think his resume may have contained puffery, but he never checked into the key background of a man who was going to be key in going to the market. It is also, the court found, that plaintiffs, or no reasonable person, would have ever invested in CSP if they had known of the true nature of the feasibility studies or the background, and nobody would have invested $2.1 million in it, would have made Mr. Katz their fiduciary, or bought into a business plan, the cornerstone of which was to present fraudulent feasibility studies to the bond market, to townships. As a matter of fact, the court found that that business practice would subject you to criminal liability. Now, the defense, the number one defense that Mr. Katz has raised, is that a boilerplate integration clause somehow bars claims under Statutory Securities Act or the common law. That argument is, in fact, an incredible argument. The Court of Chancery properly found that the integration clause is a boilerplate integration clause. An integration clause is designed that says the obligations of the parties are limited to the written agreement. The scope of their obligations is defined by the agreement. You cannot go varying the terms of the agreement by bringing in parole, written, or contemporaneous evidence. That is what an integration clause is. As we put forth in the Court of Chancery, in the first 2 weeks of 1994, there were 700 agreements filed with the SEC that had integration clauses in them. There were 500 clauses that had been filed with the FCC that were labeled 18.1 entire agreement. The integration clauses boilerplate, we put forth form books that had, this is an integration clauses boilerplate in LLC agreements. None of the form books, if this had the effect of eliminating or limiting claims under the Securities Act, you surely the people who did the form books would have put that in there. They don't, because nobody understands an integration clause to have this type of effect, because every commercial agreement, or practically every commercial agreement, has it
It would have the effect of saying there is no more securities claims, there is no more fraudulent inducement claims. And the important thing to note on what people understand, what people in the business world understand, when we filed our complaint, Mr. Katz filed his answer, represented by the firm of Richards, Layton & Finger, a very sophisticated law firm. They filed a 25-page answer. They filed an 11-page, 11 affirmative defenses, 3 counterclaims. They never raised the issue of a boilerplate integration clause being a bar to statutory or common law claims. It was only until much later, months later, where the issue was raised sous sponte in conversation at a status conference that it was brought forward, that this claim was brought forward. So nobody understands that this type of integration, boilerplate integration clause, bars these types of claims. Certainly it was not negotiated. It was put in, there's testimony from the lawyer who drafted for Mr. Katz that this was simply boilerplate that was put in. Again, it follows the form book. Furthermore, the direct holding of this court in Norton v. Proclus is not just integration clauses, but as the Court of Chancery said, the Court of Norton said that express anti-reliance clauses do not bar fraudulent inducement claims. And the law of Pennsylvania is the same. This is quite a hurdle which Mr. Katz asked this court to accept. He asked the court to accept that practically every agreement in the whole commercial world now contains, unbeknownst to anybody, unbeknownst to the drafters, unbeknownst to the parties themselves, contrary to the controlling law of this court, contrary to the controlling law of the Pennsylvania court, contrary to the law of many states that we cited, contrary to all of the treatises and the horn books which explain what integration clauses are, that they're all wrong, and that now there is a blanket bar in all cases. It goes too far, and it is simply not supported by the law. Of course, there is, I know as a side, there's an easy way to get rid of this, this argument at all, and that is Mr. Katz is not even a party to the LLC agreement in which he claims the benefit, and the agreement has a very tight no third party rights clause at section 18.7. Now, this exact issue was raised in the Chancery Court under different, on one of Mr. Katz's counterclaims, where Mr. Katz sought the benefits of a confidentiality provision. The Court of Chancery said, you're not a party to the agreement. You don't have any rights under it. And the argument that Mr. Katz said, well, I have a beneficiary right because I am a representative of the corporation. The Court of Chancery rejected it, said there is no such thing as a representative of a corporation. It rejected that claim, and Mr. Katz does not appeal it. Mr. Katz's argument to why he's now a beneficiary of this agreement, even though he's not a party to the agreement, is the exact same argument that was made to the Chancery Court, that was rejected by the Chancery Court, in which he does not appeal. And it was also contrary to the Sunquest case, which we cite. But besides that initial standing argument, Mr. Katz also argues that this boilerplate integration clause now has the effect of eviscerating any securities claim. Well, that goes, of course, contrary to the Securities Act itself. The Pennsylvania Securities Act has a provision that says that Section 507 says that it voids any provision that seeks to waive provisions of the Securities Act. The Pennsylvania Act, the wording of that provision, is the exact same as under the Model Act, the Model Uniform Securities Act, of which the Pennsylvania Act is based, and it's also the same language that's found in the 1933 Act, in which the Model Act is based, and it's also the same in the 1934 Act. All of the cases hold that you cannot put in something that waives the Securities Act. And the Third Circuit in AES versus Dow said the same thing, that you simply cannot waive it. And that case had a much more explicit anti-reliance clause, not simply a boilerplate integration clause. But the extent their argument is based on that the integration clause somehow shows that there's a lack of reliance. Again, under the Securities Act, under the Uniform Securities Act, Section 501, there is no reliance requirement. The Securities Act is based on the Uniform Act, which says, the comparable Uniform Act, which is Section 401, no reliance requirement. That is based on the 1933 Act, Section 1202, no reliance requirement. And that is, of course, the Hornbook Law, and we've cited all of that in our brief. There cannot be really any serious argument that reliance is an element of the Uniform Act under Section 501. Therefore, their argument is illogical that a boilerplate integration clause has the effect of wiping out Securities Act claims, because every agreement would wipe out securities claims. Now, the language that is cited, that the cases that are cited by Mr. Katz in his defense are all distinguishable. First of all, this is a case, as the Court of Chancery pointed out, where the contract to make somebody your fiduciary. Right? This court is very strict. That says if you seek to waive your fiduciary, and also Mr. Katz owed fiduciary duties as a promoter. We cited loads of case law that a person promoting an entity where you seek to make the plaintiff their beneficiary, you owe fiduciary duties of disclosure, which were breached. This court has long said that if you seek to waive fiduciary duties, it must be explicit. This court also said in the DuPont versus Evergreen, Florida Evergreen case, in which there was a settlement agreement, and later the plaintiffs came back and said, we want to rescind the settlement agreement because of fraud and inducement. This court said that a settlement agreement, which purports to waive all claims, okay, cannot waive a fraudulent inducement claim unless the waiver is explicit to the exact fraud. So it is illogical that a boilerplate integration clause could waive Mr. Katz's fiduciary duties, and it is illogical that a boilerplate integration clause could somehow waive all of the rights to waive any plaintiff's claim under common law or under the Securities Act. The cases that are cited by Mr. Katz do not deal with inducements into a fiduciary relationship. The cases they do cite involve cases where there is a more explicit anti-reliance clause in addition to integration clause, or they involve cases where the party in question was attempting to claim as a fraudulent inducement based on prior representations when the subject matter of those prior representations was expressly integrated into the contract. In other words, in one of the cases they cite, the party expressly said, I will not file for a mechanics lien. And then they went ahead and filed a mechanics lien and said, well, I was fraudulently induced because I didn't know I'd have to file it. In other words, what they were really doing was they were trying to alter the terms of the agreement based on prior representations. Again, completely distinguishable, not cases which you're, again, referring to boilerplate integration clauses. Now, going back to the original claims themselves, first under the Security Act, I don't think there is really a serious argument that the misrepresentations involving the feasibility studies or the criminal acts constitute violations of the Security Acts or would constitute material misrepresentations. There is some hint in the brief that it wasn't material, but Mr. Katz admits in his deposition that the feasibility studies were material to their investment. That somehow that the plaintiffs didn't rely on it. Mr. Katz testified he gave them the feasibility studies that they would rely on that in making their investment decision. The real defense that appears to be culled is kind of a I didn't know defense, which under the Securities Act is the burden of Mr. Katz to come forth with material facts that would show that in the exercise of reasonable care, he could not have known of these facts. Well, that's really a non-starter for the Mount Laurel feasibility study. He did it. He wrote it. He wrote the sections that were said that JRB did. He wrote the sections. The charts that said that they were performed by JRB, him and his employees did the section. They took specific kickbacks from JRB of $10,000 to do it. He knew it all the time. He testified that he didn't tell him. He didn't tell the underwriters. He didn't tell the government officials. He certainly didn't tell our clients that the premise of the business plan was to give fraudulent feasibility studies. No investor would ever invest based on that type of plan. Mr. Katz himself has testified that if he somehow knew that the Philadelphia study was not done by Dr. Vivian, he would have called the whole thing off. Of course, any reasonable person, the underwriter said if they'd known that the feasibility studies were drafted by Katz instead of by an independent party, they wouldn't have had anything to do with it. So the only issue is, could he in reasonable care have known? But of course he knew, because he drafted the documents. He drafted the feasibility studies. To the extent he didn't know about Mr. Katz, I'm sorry, to the extent Mr. Katz didn't know about Mr. Robbins' criminal record, again, in the exercise of reasonable care, you are one associate who you're putting forth to the securities market, who you're putting forth to the plaintiffs as your trusted right-hand man, and who you believe his resume is puffed. It certainly is an exercise of reasonable care to do the most basic question, what were you doing these years? Where were you when it would have easily been found out that the man was in jail? The same arguments are made in the under common law. All the elements of a common law misrepresentation entitled to rescission are met. And the only answer to why we wouldn't be entitled to rescission under a fiduciary disclosure claim is that somehow is barred by the integration clause. Again, as I dealt with before, that would not be a meritorious argument. Finally, in really an attempt to try anything once they were caught, they allege in their briefs that we cannot complain of the damages that we cause, that the damages we seek are somehow caused by the plaintiffs. Again, the argument's not supported by the record, not supported by the court. Mr. Katz was always in control of CSP. As a matter of fact, he brought claims on behalf of CSP. But what's telling about the argument is they said that somehow the plaintiffs tanked the BRIC project. Now, the BRIC project, of course, comes about long after we invested. And again, there's no case law that says that the Pennsylvania Securities Act or the common law is somehow eliminated because of a failure to fund down the road or our claims for rescission. But what's telling about the BRIC study, Mr. Jenkins says, is that somehow the BRIC study failed because of us. But the BRIC project was based on a completely fraudulent feasibility study that was presented to the BRIC township officials by Mr. Katz, where it says in 100 different places it was done by JRB, when in fact it was not. How long would it have been before the BRIC people found out and said, we wouldn't have anything to do with you? Thank you.
Your Honor, this shows 9 minutes remaining, which I suspect is incorrect. I'd be happy to talk for 9 minutes, but I had only reserved five.
If I were you, I'd talk for five.
I would talk with five, Your Honor. Let me go through some of Mr. Lesner's points. He first stated, and I think this is just an overstatement, but let me point it out, that the feasibility studies in question were completely done by Mr. Katz and Mr. Robbins. We point out in our briefs that there are material facts in dispute over that question. Of course, this was summary judgment granted below, material facts in dispute that cannot be resolved against our client. He, at several times in his presentation and numerous times in the brief, the integration clause was referred to here as boilerplate, as if there was something wrong with that, as if there is some reason not to enforce it. We found the decision of Judge Easterbrook from the Seventh Circuit in Rissman versus Rissman, who makes the common sense interpretation boilerplate merely means it's been used many times successfully. That's a reason to enforce the provision, not to overturn it. He also states that, Mr. Lester also stated that nobody understands an integration clause of this sort to have the effect we claim. With respect, that is incorrect. We've set forth in our brief a number of cases that interpret integration clauses almost word for word with what we have here as barring a fraud in the inducement claim. I also noted that in my presentation this morning, as we did in our briefs, we focused on the word inducement. This is a fraud in the inducement claim. Plaintiffs said they were no inducements other than those in the agreement. I did not hear a response to that. I don't think there is one. We turn to the Pennsylvania Security Act, where we're focused on the AES case, Judge Stapleton's decision in the Third Circuit, where she says that you cannot waive the provisions of the Pennsylvania Securities Act. AES actually didn't discuss the Pennsylvania Securities Act. It was discussing Federal Securities Act. But let's assume it would apply there. As the Third Circuit stated in AES, all right, that means you can't use an integration clause as a complete bar, but it is very strong evidence of what the plaintiffs were properly allowed to rely on, and he intimates that with an integration clause, although you couldn't win an automatic decision on summary judgment, you could win after trial once the court determined why are the plaintiffs signing this integration clause and yet saying, oh, well, it doesn't mean anything. So the AES decision, even if applicable, is not at all hurtful for our case, we believe. We then go on to his argument on the contract, that this was a contract to become a fiduciary. I should note that the Court of Chancery never decided that question. It is on appeal here. The way around that, of course, is that you can waive your fiduciary duties by a clear contract, and that's what we have. We believe the integration clause clearly waives the plaintiff's claims here. Going on to the factual questions here, Mr. Lester says that Mr. Katz argues that he did not know, and there's certainly no dispute that Mr. Katz did not know certain of the matters here concerning specifically Mr. Robbins' criminal background. The question, however, is not whether he knew or not, whether he had a duty to look into Mr. Robbins' criminal background and a duty to investigate the representations that Mr. Robbins were making with him. Let me give 1 minute of factual summary. These feasibility studies were not initially intended for the plaintiffs. They did review them, they did look at them, but that wasn't their purpose. The feasibility studies were to persuade people to invest in the projects. In order to do that, the person signing off on the study, in this case Jack Vivian, was going to have to stand behind them. Mr. Katz learned later that although Mr. Robbins was telling him, oh yes, Mr. Vivian has signed off on all these feasibility studies, Mr. Robbins was not telling the truth. Did Mr. Katz have a duty, however, to look into that? Well, Mr. Robbins was a trusted subordinate at the time. Wasn't later, but was at the time. And we submit that in most business decisions, in most businesses that we know of, if you rely upon a trusted subordinate, that you're not going to investigate their every utterance. That is, if you ask a trusted subordinate, please do this. Please see that Mr. Vivian has signed off on all of these feasibility studies, and Mr. Robbins comes back to him and says, he's done it. What business leader is going to pick up the phone and check that out? We submit that very few would do so. But the point here on summary judgment is there was no analysis of this below. There was no evidence put on this on either way, and we think this was improper on summary judgment. I see that my 5 minutes is up. Unless the court has any questions, I will stop.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Take it under advisement and we'll adjourn.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honor.